Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and this is our last show pretty much for the year as far as content goes. And so what we believe is what we really need to cover for, to end this all up, to put all the things together, is kind of the example that a constitutional president will always stand up, regardless of whether it's a big, beautiful bill or not. If it is not constitutional, a constitutional president will veto that bill. It's no more, if back in those days, it was not about agendas. It was not about what, you know, we want to do or how we want, you know, our presidency to do things. It is serving the people by serving or fulfilling our roles and responsibilities within that Constitution. And we have three presidents that took a stand. One of them had a complete exemplary career, which is the father of the Constitution, which is James Madison. The second president, which is James Monroe, the president that basically preceded him, and he also did what needed to be done by following Madison's example. Later on, Congress finally came to, so I'll get into the story of each of these as we do this, but bottom line, Jackson being the third president, and actually a surprise that he, as big government Jackson, actually decided to follow suit and veto these attempts. So welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Okay. And so what we're going to be covering are the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. And so nobody today has taken a stand in identifying that the Department of Transportation is absolutely unconstitutional. Nobody bats an eye at this. No patriot organization. There is no, you know, like, you know, right to life. You know, hey, federal government, get off of our freeways. Get out of our modes of transportation. You don't have the authority. I mean, everybody right now is saying get out of our families because it's gotten that bad. Because we never, a long, long time ago, said, leave our roadways, highways, and transportation system alone. Had we stood up a long, long time ago, and folks, when did this all start? Well, Sean's at a disadvantage, so I'm not going to put him on the spot. I covered this year. We uncovered for the first time that they began creating a Ponzi scheme and creating a public lands scheme of selling state land by the federal government, unconstitutionally doing so, to help pay for infrastructure between the states and so forth, and to basically capture money out of the states to build this thing we call DC. And the money that they spent in this and the things that they did is absolutely surprising. I mean, you know, they're supposed to be paying for themselves to doing what they can, but come on, they're not to put the burden on the states so that they can have a better lifestyle. That is antithetical to the whole point of creating the federal government to serve us. And yet, if you're familiar with what they have done within D.C., I mean, most people don't even know that there's an underground in D.C., most people, I mean, why did they do all of these things and spend all the money that they did in D.C.? That being what it is, the focus today is not what happened in D.C. It is what happened in 1817. In 1816, Congress, recognizing Madison, and as a matter of fact, in 1816, they created the Indiana Enabling Act in the summer of that, and they came to Madison around the same time to say, hey, you're about to, you know, to retire as president. What could we do that would actually help, you know, create a hallmark legislation for your service, because you've been the exemplar servant to the Union? And Madison, instead of actually answering the question, he goes down this ideological, not rant, but talks about Adam Smith and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and points out that, you know, it just seems very obvious that now that we are a peaceful, tranquil nation, not being harassed by foreign, you know, nations, that everybody's kind of, we're doing all by ourselves really well. Excuse me. And so Madison goes into this, you know, I'll just say this forward look, or this futuristic look of America, to say, if we could improve our movement of commerce by improving our transportation system, in other words, our highways, our waterways, and being able to move commerce more efficiently in as well as out of the nation, into the interstates and to the, you know, to the ports, to go out to the world, the more efficient we can move commerce, the more stronger we will become as a nation. And this is something that Adam Smith highlighted in The Wealth of Nations. So I don't want to say it was common knowledge, but those people who knew what Adam Smith saw, the potential of America, and he kind of warned that if America could actually go down this path. Remember, 1876 is when The Wealth of Nations was created, and I believe when it was written. And this was at the point in time where the colonies were being harassed, and the colonies were in this bubble. I don't know if he wrote it before or after, because I don't think it was before or after, I mean. I think he wrote it before the Declaration of Independence. He felt that eventually things would work out, that America would become this nation that would have this economic strength because of its potential. I mean, if you look at all of the different waterways that we have compared to all the other nations, wow. So this really struck Madison, and Madison kind of shared this with these few congressmen friends that came over that have known him for a long time. So they go back over to kind of work on, he's given us this idea, what are we going to do? And they come up with this bill, and it is called the Bonus Bill. It is kind of nutshelled, but the name of the bill was an act to set apart and pledge certain funds for internal improvements, and which sets apart pledges and funds, quote, for constructing roads and canals and improving the navigation of watercourses in order to facilitate, promote, and give security to internal commerce among the several states, and to render more easy and less expensive the means and provisions for the common defense, close quote. So that was the name of the act. Talk about a long name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to read Madison's veto response, because they came back with this act to basically take and tax the states so that they could do these highway and waterway improvements and establish new roads and so forth to kind of actualize what Adam Smith was talking about, as Adam, or basically as James Madison, you know, kind of expressed to them that he saw that the nation needed to do this. So let's go ahead and pick it up right there with I Am Constrained, because this is Madison's veto statement to this bill. Go ahead.
I am constrained by the insuperable difficulty I feel in reconciling the bill with the Constitution of the United States, to return it with that objection to the House of Representatives in which it originated. The legislative powers vested in Congress are specified and enumerated in the 8th section of the 1st article of the Constitution, and it does not appear that the power proposed to be exercised by the bill is among the enumerated powers, or that it falls by any just interpretation with the power to make laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution those or other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States.
Okay, right there. So the first thing he says here is that the legislative powers vested in Congress, in other words, those things that Congress can actually make law on, that they have the ability to either create or do because of these very specific powers, are identified. They're enumerated. Enumeration means they are listed in the eighth section of the first article of the Constitution. The reason this is important, folks, is because it's not listed anywhere else. The powers for legislative powers, period. In other words, Article 1, Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, Section 7, Section 9, and Section 10 are off limits. Congress cannot make legislative, they can't make laws regarding anything within those sections, only Section 8. So when we see that Congress took upon itself the Reapportionment Act to basically decide how many people they were going to represent, which we find up in Article 1, Section 2, and it, you know, all these other things that they've started creating, such as the Electoral College changes to where the parties get to choose instead of following the 12th Amendment, which is Article 2, basically the Electoral College, Article 2 of the 12th Amendment. My point is, friends, that Madison right here basically points to exactly the only area in the Constitution other than powers granted to Congress in an amendment that allows them to create law, which the one amendment that I know of was the Prohibition Act, where they could create law to basically regulate this, the production of distilled spirits and so forth. I can't think of any amendment that actually gave the 17th Amendment, not the 17th, 16th Amendment, by changing the taxation of going from apportionment to income tax, not giving them the power to create the IRS. So I don't want to get wrapped up into this. The whole point is, if you're looking for anything, any proof and evidence that they can only make law, you know, out of these, out of this one small section, because the enumerated color-coded constitution we have on the website actually says the exact same thing. This is the only place where they have the power to create law. We highlight every other little niche that you would might find in the Constitution, you know, such as the amendments and so forth, because we identify this with our color-coded constitution, how they can create law. The next thing he actually goes into is he identifies one of the clauses, which is there, the power to make laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution those or other powers vested in the Constitution. In other words, in this one paragraph, he basically says that this is not a power that's within Article 1, Section 8, and there's this clause of making power to make necessary the proper laws for the execution of the foregoing powers. The point is, folks, he's already pointing to the necessary and proper clause as saying that clause cannot be applicable in creating this law because those powers don't exist, like he just stated, that they're not there, so you can't claim the necessary and proper clause to justify that you're creating this, these laws. In other words, this is a huge rebuke and a lesson to Congress in how they have completely misconstrued the Constitution by assuming that they could use the necessary and proper clause. And then they go into this next paragraph where he identifies another clause that they've misconstrued as well. Go ahead.
The power to regulate commerce among the several states cannot include a power to construct roads and canals and to improve the navigation of watercourse in order to facilitate, promote, and secure such commerce without a latitude of construction departing from the ordinary import of the terms. Strengthened by the known inconveniences which doubtless led to the grant of this remedial power to Congress.
Okay, so right there, the power to regulate commerce, which they use all the time to say, because we have this power to regulate commerce, we can do this. And he said, no, that is not a portal to being able to create new powers or extend your powers into things that are not specifically pertaining to the commerce among the states. They've actually interpreted this to actually be able to regulate commerce within the states, which is literally a complete redefining of that little line among the several states. So now he gets into the General Defense and Welfare Clause and the Supremacy Clause as well in this next paragraph. So let's go ahead and dive into what he says in this next paragraph.
To refer the power in question to the clause, quote, to provide for common defense and general welfare, end quote, would be contrary to the established and consistent rules of interpretation, as rendering the special and careful enumeration of powers which follow the clause negatory and improper. Such a view of the Constitution would have the effect of giving to Congress a general power of legislation instead of the defined and limited one hitherto understood to belong to them. The terms, quote, common defense and general welfare, end quote, embracing every object and act within the purview of a legislative trust. It would have the effect of subjecting both the Constitution and laws of the several states in all cases not specifically exempted to be superseded by laws of Congress, it being expressly declared that the Constitution of the United States and laws made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land, and judges of every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding, end quote. Such a view of the Constitution, finally, would have the effect of excluding the judicial authority of the United States from its participation in guarding the boundary between the legislative powers of the general and the state governments. And as much as questions relating to the general welfare, being questions of policy and expediency, are unsusceptible of judicial cognizance and decision.
Okay, so here he actually goes into both of them and ties this general defense and welfare clause to actually, if they actually use that, then it is limitless, because basically he's repeating what he said in the cod fishery bounties, that if they could do this, then there would be no limit to what they could do, and that then everything that they did would make these acts or these laws of Congress so supreme that it would basically negate the intent of the judiciary, as he said in the cod fishery bounties. Remember that?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It sounds like the exact same quote.
There you go. So the consistency that Madison made. So because I've been, you know, having to deal with these different actions, these different paths of resistance from the sovereign citizen movement, nullification, blah, blah, blah. In the nullification movement, there has been, and you can actually find publications out there that kind of disingenuously denigrate Madison being inconsistent and waffling and so forth. I will tell you, when you read anything and everything Madison did in a formal capacity, in communicating somebody very specific, it's one thing that Madison may be writing a letter to Jefferson where they kind of articulate these ideas of usufruct and these other things of, you know, just milling about ideas. That is not the same thing as an official capacity. So an official capacity is how we judge their service, not by, you know, their ideas. And in those days, you know, if it was done, you know, as just milling about ideas, that was always actually encouraged, you know, that somebody, you know, is thinking out of the box, what have you. But when they acted in their official capacity, they acted in the specific, you know, those things, those specific roles and responsibilities that they had. Madison never violated that, or at least he was the closest to not violating his roles and responsibilities as a congressman, as well as a secretary of state, as well as the president of the United States, period. He was an exemplar servant. So the point that I'm trying to make here, folks, is that as we read Kevin Gutzman on the 10th Amendment Center, where they have this document that denigrates Madison as a waffler. He vacillated. No, Madison evolved. Madison had these ideas going into the Constitution based on what was in his head of what we needed to do. That whole idea evolved, and by the time the Constitution ended and the ratification debates began, and to be clear, what he did with the Federalist Papers was really more of a concerted effort under the management of Hamilton. Hamilton requested that he come up and assist him because he was a brilliant man. And there's no doubt in my mind, they discussed what they needed to talk about. And so Madison obliged him, knowing that the Federalist Papers were just editorials. These were not official capacity documents that they made them into. Madison had no idea that Hamilton had this, has concocted this scheme. He was completely unaware of the scheme of Hamilton's to get the Federalist Papers to be adopted as the go-to guide in understanding the Constitution, which is exactly what the jurists of the Supreme Court did. Which is why we actually read them and use them, which is why the ratification debates were buried for a couple hundred years, literally buried. Nobody was using them. But as we've gone through this whole year, we've proven how Madison has consistently pointed to the ratification debates and never once mentioned the Federalist Papers, never once in a formal capacity have I ever found anything. Folks, if you've got the evidence, send it to me. I will be happy to say, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Here, Madison actually said something, you know, referencing the Federalist Papers, because I've never found it, never once in his formal function as president, secretary of state, so forth and so on. So let's go on to the next one. Keep going. A restriction of the power
to provide for the common defense and general welfare, the creatures of which are to be provided for by the expenditure of money, would still leave within legislature power of Congress all the great and most important measures of government, money being the ordinary and necessary means of carrying them into execution.
There you go. So he's just expounding again what he said about the cod fishery bounties and so forth above. Keep going.
If a general power to construct roads and canals and to improve the navigation of watercourses with the train of powers incident thereto be not possessed by Congress, the assent of the states in the mode provided in the bill cannot confer the power. The only cases in which the consent and session of particular states can extend the power of Congress are those specified and provided for in the Constitution.
Okay, so again, he's basically laying it down that it, you can only do those things that are extended or actually specified in the Constitution. In other words, implication of power is something that is just, it is antithetical to the enumerations. They listed specifically what they could create the laws on, not the use of implications. Go ahead. So this is as fine.
I'm not unaware of the great importance of roads and canals and the improved navigation of watercourses, and that a power in the national legislature to provide for them might be exercised with signal advantage to the general prosperity. But seeing that such a power is not expressly given by the Constitution, and believing that it cannot be deduced from any part of it without an immiscible latitude of construction and reliance on insufficient precedents, believing also that the permanent success of the Constitution depends on a definite partition of powers between the general and state governments, and that no adequate landmarks would be left by the constructive extension of the powers of Congress as proposed in the bill, I have no option but to withhold my signature from it, and to cherishing the hope that its beneficial objects may be attained by a resort for the necessary powers to the same wisdom and virtue in the nation which established the Constitution in its actual form and providently marked out in the instrument itself a safe and practicable mode of improving it as experience might suggest.
Yeah, so that little providently marked out, I mean, in other words, you know, divinely marked out. Going back up, one of the things that I wanted to jump into, but you took off, which is okay. Looking up, again, it says in the previous paragraph, the only cases in which the consent and secession of particular states can extend the power of Congress are those specified, provided for in the Constitution. In other words, the only cases where this can be done legitimately is through the Article 5 process. So in other words, even if the states decided, and as a matter of fact, it says, leading into this, if a general power to construct roads, we're going into a break. So when we come back, I'll reconstruct that one paragraph leading into this. Because people, we have states actually going along with the federal government and doing things, as Madison said. Hey, even if they decide to go down this path, it does not truly extend the power. They're exercising power not granted. In other words, it will always be a violation of the Constitution that later generations say, hey, where did you get the power to do this? We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as Madison was stating in that paragraph that actually pointed out that they had to follow the Article 5 process, he said that if a general power to construct the roads and canals and to improve the navigation of watercourses with the terrain of the powers incident with the train of powers incident thereto, be not possessed by Congress, the assent of the states in the mode provided in the bill cannot confer the power. In other words, so he's pointing out that, yeah, the states might actually let you do this because they become it becomes a benefit for them, but it doesn't confer the power. The only way that that power can actually be extended is through the Article 5 process. Again, the point is that down the road, when we realize that they're exercising power, they have no authority, we can literally shut it down. Because once it's a violation, unless they finally amend the Constitution and giving them the power, and folks, listen to what I'm telling you, I'm pleading, do not allow the federal government to have this power. They are the epitome of a general government that can maintain a military force, fight war. I mean, look at what we have and what they have done in our security. Bar none, the United States is the global power. The only reason that we are no longer, we're actually being competed with by Russia and China is because we've been facilitating their buildup. We have basically created economic advantages so that they could maintain competitiveness, because that way we can continue to spend more of your money. The bottom line is this, is if we get this government to do the things that it's supposed to do and stop spending, because they started getting away with doing this transportation crap in the Ponzi scheme in 1820. And if because they got away with that, they got away with the next thing and the next thing. And eventually in the early 1900s, they got away with actually subsidizing communism throughout the world. Before 1950, we were subsidizing both Russia as well as China for them to basically develop themselves and become formidable forces to literally drive us into this Cold War, so that they can use fear to keep us divided instead of actually making the plea to the world to embrace liberty and to come into the United States under our Constitution. And they actually sponsored this thing called the United Nations and this whole globalist movement. I want to be clear here, folks. It all started with this, and this is equally unconstitutional with everything else that they've done. We don't have to allow it, and the authority rests in those states. That's why we just went through those Kentucky and Virginia resolutions and interposition to ultimately get the true nullification we must interpose. Nobody wants you to connect these dots. This will actually sever the chains that the globalists have over the United States and this incestual relationship with corporations and the globalist movement. This is the true threat that they fear, us taking America back by using the Constitution. Learn, pray, act. I can't emphasize this. Understand what we have to do. It is all about constitutional compliance, and Madison laid it out in this very specific veto statement. It is that powerful. It is so powerful, I shared this with Glenn Beck in the early, 2012, around that time frame. And as a matter of fact, I got feedback from Trevor Lawton's wife, his beautiful bride, and we sat, at a Constitutional Association meeting where she was telling me, she was beaming about, yeah, I read this veto, this bonus bill veto, and I did all the research, and you were absolutely right. And I go, so what did Glenn Beck, because I was the one telling Glenn Beck, you need to read this, you need to understand this. She was one of his researchers. And what did he do? Nothing. He continually entertains us on how bad the picture is and what the threat is and all these things, and gets you to buy the products that he supports for you to buy. And I guess, he does that because, he's just a good, noble guy. He's not making any money off of it. I will stop with the sarcasm now. Let's move forward. So bottom line. This veto statement went out. It was a very powerful veto statement from Madison that let everybody understand that this power did not exist. Therefore, Congress went out and said, you know what? We're not going to not do this again. So they waited until the next president came along. And so James Monroe, being the next president, they waited until May 4th, 1822, when finally James Monroe vetoed the bill. The bill was passed probably in the early 1822, after he took on, I believe, his second, because when was he elected? He was elected in 1816, so he was halfway through his second and final term, with John Quincy Adams getting elected in 1824 and then losing to Jackson. So as we look at this, in the last 2 years, they say, well, let's give Monroe a try. Let's see if we can get this by Monroe. So they give him a bill or an act, and this is the title of the act, an act for the preservation and repair of the Cumberland Road. So this is all that they put into this. And so Monroe basically gives them a veto statement on, the 4th of May, 1822. So what we're going to read is just a segment out of this. And so, Sean, go ahead and start with the center of that second paragraph, and we'll read it through that. Go ahead.
A right to legislate for one of these purposes is a right to legislate for the others. It is a complete right of jurisdiction and sovereignty for all the purposes of internal improvement, and not merely the right of applying money under the power vested in Congress to make appropriations, under which power, with consent of the states through which this road passes, the work was originally commenced and has been so far executed. I am of opinion that Congress do not possess this power, that the states individually cannot grant it. For although they may assent to the appropriation of money within their limits for such purposes, they can grant no power, jurisdiction, or sovereignty by special compacts with the United States. This power can be granted only by an amendment to the Constitution and in the mode prescribed by it.
Okay, so the power exists. So right there, he actually said something that Madison really didn't say, because Madison was more succinct and more kind of intellectual, I think Monroe was a little more succinct. This power can only be granted by an amendment to the Constitution. In other words, as he goes, that this power doesn't exist and that it can't be given by the consent of a separate compact with these other states. Because apparently this bill was going to get these other states to kind of say, okay, we're going to kind of allow you to do this by this passing of this bill. But the reality is, as he said it, this power can only be granted by an amendment to the Constitution in the mode prescribed. In other words, the Article 5 process, period. Go ahead.
If the power exists, it must be either because it has been specifically granted to the United States or that it is an incidental to some power which has been specifically granted. If we examine the specific grants of power, we do not find it among them, nor is it incidental to any power which has been specifically granted. It has never been contended that the power is specifically granted. It is claimed only as being incidental to some one or more of the powers which are specifically granted. The following are the powers from which it is said to be derived. First, from the right to establish post offices and post roads. Second, from the right to declare war. Third, to regulate commerce. Fourth, to pay the debts and provide for common defense and general welfare. Fifth, from the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution all the powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Sixth, and lastly, from the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and other property of the United States.
Okay, so what he's basically said, leading into the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, is he says the following are the powers from which it is said to be derived. In other words, these were the justifications that Congress listed in the bill to say, well, we're going to do this because we have the power to establish post roads and post offices. Second, we have the right to declare war. And third, so because we have to declare war, we have to have a road to be able to, you know, move the war among. Now, let's be clear here. War, if it's going to be executed, would be executed within the United States. They didn't have the power to declare war by using the army or anything else other than via an invasion or insurrection. So to be clear, they're talking about internal improvements for using the army, not the Navy. The Navy was the force to fight our wars, the Navy and the Marine Corps. Third, to regulate commerce. Fourth, to pay the debts and provide for common defense and welfare. So it's going through all of these lists, and then the power to make needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. So they were looking at the territory way over to the west and saying, that's where we may actually have to go to fight war. Bottom line, as you just read, according to my judgment, it cannot be derived from either of these powers, nor from all of them united. And in consequence, it does not exist. And then basically Monroe goes on and says, hey, you know, I want to see this amendment. Let's go get the amendment. And instead of Congress spending energy in creating an amendment and passing it by two-thirds through the House and through the Senate, instead of a basic majority, they decided to just wait till they could find the next president that would allow them to do this. And so instead of, because I'm not aware of them going to John Quincy Adams, and John Quincy Adams was probably an acorn that didn't fall far from the tree. There's probably a little bit of dislikement from most of Congress towards John Quincy Adams, because John Adams himself was not a man that was, you know, I guess, affable and enjoyed, you know, he was viewed as a pompous politician. I don't think that John Quincy Adams was as bad, but I just, for some reason, they chose not to put a bill in his hands. They waited. And in such, they waited until Andrew Jackson became president. And so it was in, what is it? I've got it right here. We'll get to it. In the Andrew Jackson veto statement, his veto statement came out on the 27th of May, 1830. So in other words, they waited 8 years from the attempt with Monroe before they put another bill out there to actually justify this need for this power for them to assume. Not to amend the Constitution, but to assume. So they gave him a bill, and this is what he says. Gentlemen, I have maturely considered the bill proposing to authorize, quote, a subscription of stock. So now they took on this new twist that they wanted to create a subscription of stock in the Maysville, Washington, Paris, and Lexington Turnpike Road Company, and now basically create taxation to basically utilize this company or these companies to start doing road improvements and so forth. So they came at this with a different view. Instead of just, you know, getting the funding to spend on it, they actually wanted to create a corporation or amalgamate these Maysville, Washington, Paris, and Lexington Turnpike Road Company. Now, whether that was just one company, just with an extended long name, or whatever, they wanted to basically make that a federal corporation where they would actually funnel the money into that company to do roadways and waterway improvements. So bottom line, as Jackson looked at this bill, he provides a 9-page, we don't even have time to read through all of this, but he provides this 9-page veto statement in explaining what they're asking for just doesn't exist. And so as we kind of go through this, we start off on page 2, where Jackson goes through these remarks where were made by both Madison and Monroe. And I want to make sure that if they were adopted up there, where he was talking about this. And no, I don't see it. So it'll probably come through as he probably cites, because what he cites here is how Madison vetoed this, how Monroe vetoed this, and so bottom line, he's going to veto this as well. In other words, you know, if he remembers that this is something they can't do, they don't have the power to do, he didn't want to be outed by anybody that might also remember that these men had already vetoed these things. You know, Jackson had been around a while. I mean, he was, you know, down in Louisiana during the 1812 war. And he was serving in Congress. As a matter of fact, he was serving in Congress when Washington was retiring. A little bit of, you know, here's a little bit on Jackson. When Washington walked down to basically retire, Jackson wore his hat. He had, you know, whatever that hat he had. I can't tell you, I've never seen a picture of it, but it was told that he was the only gentleman in the room that did not remove his hat when Washington walked by. In other words, it was blatant disrespect for Washington. So that's the kind of tone that Jackson entered as a freshman congressman into service. And later on, as a seasoned whatever colonel, I think he was a colonel in Louisiana during the 1812 war. So bottom line, he's grown and grown, and now at this point in his, you know, elderly state of life, he becomes the president of the United States and doesn't want to be remembered as the guy who remembered what the others did, that he was the guy that went against that. So he at least held the line on this one thing, even though he did all sorts of atrocities as a president, unconstitutional. Here's the one point where he took a stand and said, this is unconstitutional, we can't do this. So let's start with that paragraph on page 2, to avoid these evils. Let's go ahead.
To avoid these evils, it appears to me that the most safe, just, and federal disposition which could be made of the surplus revenue would be its apportionment among the several states according to their ratio of representation. And should this measure not be found warranted by the Constitution, that it would be expedient to propose to the states an amendment authorizing it. The constitutional power of the federal government to construct or promote works of internal improvement presents itself in two points of view. The first is bearing upon the sovereignty of the states within those limits their execution is contemplated, if jurisdiction of the territory which they may occupy be claimed as necessary to their preservation and use. The second is asserting the simple right to appropriate money from the national treasury in aid of such works when undertaken by state authority, surrendering the claim of jurisdiction. In the first view, the question of power is an open one and can be decided without the embarrassments attending the other. arising from the practice of government. Although frequently and strenuously attempted, the power to this extent has never been exercised by the government in a single instance. It does not, in my opinion, possess it. And no bill, therefore, which admits it, can receive my official sanction.
Okay, so right there, let's stop. One of the things that most people, when they read this, they miss one thing. And it's basically, it's right here at the very beginning. He says, to avoid these evils, it appears to me that the most safe and just and federal disposition, and here's the point you need to hear, which could be made of the surplus revenue, which would be, so hold on here. The federal government had surplus revenue. At this point in time, Madison's plan to pay for the war by creating the second charter of a bank to literally just fund the war and to create a taxation strategy to get this paid off. Monroe basically said in his second inauguration in 1820 that they were well on way of actually paying this off early, which they did. I think they were targeting originally like 1840. I think Monroe basically said it looked like maybe 1835. We're talking 1830. So the strategy, because they were so diligent in paying off the war debt, the guy that just walks in and is halfway through his first term takes claim that he paid off the war debt. The point is that he's talking about now this surplus, which be its apportionment among the states according to the ratio of representation. In other words, maybe we should give the money back. Maybe we should give the money back. And basically says, going through this bill, that, you know, we shouldn't use it for that purpose because the Constitution doesn't authorize this. I'm not sure how many people, when in reading this or in hearing this, that was your first takeaway. But it was right there up front that the reason they were actually creating a bill was they had money to spend. And they wanted to do it this way. And he said, hey, maybe it'd be better just to give that money back. Imagine that. So, okay, so now let's go into this next part that we're going to read.
But in the other view of the power, the question is differently situated. The ground taken at an early period of the government was that, quote, that whenever money has been raised by the general authority and is to be applied to a particular measure, a question arises whether the particular measure be within the enumerated authorities vested in Congress. If it be, the money requisite for it may be applied to it. If not, no such application can be made.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is give Sean a little break. If we go down to page 3 and we actually identify where he's listing these dollar figures, in the next paragraph is where he mentions the administration of Mr. Madison regarding this same type of bill that he vetoed. Mr. Madison was characterized by an act which furnishes the strongest evidence of his opinion of its extent. A bill was passed through both houses of Congress and presented for his approval, setting apart these road constructions and yada, yada, yada. Regarding the bill of asserting a power in the federal government to construct roads and canals within the limits of the states, which were made, he objected to the passage. He basically is, what he's doing is he's encapsulating exactly what Madison said in his bill. And then he goes to the views later on in that same paragraph. The views of Mr. Monroe upon this subject was basically left by his administration that the power did not have it. As a matter of fact, he quotes him and says, quote, that Congress have an unlimited power to raise money and that it's inappropriate, that its appropriation, they have a discretionary power restricted only by the duty to appropriate it for the purposes of common defense of general welfare, not local, national, or state benefit, close quote. And so here we have Jackson looking at a bill and citing the fact that, hey, Madison's administration stood up against this, and Monroe's administration stood up against this. So as he's basically saying, hey, we don't have the authority to do this, right? And as we go down and we keep heading through looking for more bold text, what we'll find on page 7 is where he basically lays out, you know, his feelings and sentiments on what has to happen regarding the bill presented to him. So, Sean, go ahead and start this off at the, but I do not entertain such gloomy apprehensions. Go ahead.
If it be the wish of the people that the construction of roads and canals should be conducted by the federal government, it is not only the highly expedient but indispensably necessary that a previous amendment of the Constitution delegating the necessary power and defining and restricting its exercise with reference to the sovereignty of the states should be made. Without it, nothing extensively useful can be effected. The right to exercise as much jurisdiction as is necessary to preserve the works and to raise funds by the collection of tolls to keep them in repair cannot be dispensed with.
Okay, so
the Cumberland Road?
Yep.
Okay.
So here he is laying out the argument that, hey, you know, we should be able to do this. And actually, in this bill, he points out, or I pointed out to you, that this was a bill that was going to create take a federal corporation and start creating turnpikes or basically toll roads and toll waterways so that they could kind of self-fund as well as tax by using an amendment. They could as well as tax to do highway improvements, building roads, waterway improvements, and so forth, and building canals. Folks, here Jackson is looking at this big opportunity to create a federal corporation and is encouraging them, let's go do this. I want to do this. And if the good people, which I think they want us to do this, would, you know, would give us this amendment. So why not go get the amendment? Here it is laid at the feet of three presidents. Congress had the opportunity, was told that the good people would give us this amendment. Because they know we have faith in us. We know that they have this faith in us, and they know that we will be good to them. I think Jackson realized that down the road, this would become a tool that would become an action of war against the states. And when we look, folks, how many presidents over the past 50 years have had huge bonus bills or huge transportation bills, infrastructure bills, to the tune of trillions of dollars? Trump was one. Biden was one. Obama had his. You know, even back to Clinton. And I'm pretty sure that you could go back on and on and on. I mean, FDR and Johnson had huge, you know, expenditures on infrastructure. All unconstitutional. Nobody's been batting their eye. They've been using these infrastructure bills to funnel money to their loyalists. Anything to share, Sean? Since we're almost
sounds like the King's Highway.
Yes, yes. And so, folks, we've kind of laid it out. Here you have hardcore evidence that if it is not within the Constitution, they can't do it. And even if the states accede and they say, we'll take this money, we'll go ahead and work with you on this, that doesn't make it one permanent, nor does it legitimize it. It is still a usurpation of power. And we have all the authority to say, stop, you can't do this anymore. We're shutting you down. And the states have the ability to do this so that they can take back these powers and actually start doing things that really serve us instead of allowing them to wage war. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. Happy New Year.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.